And tonight our main speaker is Don M.
My name is Donald. I'm an alcoholic. Rita just said, have fun. I always wonder how they find your name, you know? And you get to go and share at a nice, quiet, little, easy Saturday night meeting someplace, and which is always my fantasy. I always get in that car, and, you know, they ask you in La Habra, and you think, well, Christ, La Habra, there are how many, four people? And you drive down, and you park in this little shady street, and you walk in this room in this church, and you know it's their quiet little meeting, and they're open the doors, and there are 4,000 fucking people sitting there. And all they're going to get is a sober drunk. You know, I am, by the grace of God, 7,366 days sober on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm one of the ones that got here. I had never been able to stay sober, and my life was going down the tubes, and everything about me was crashing down, and I knew I was an alcoholic, and I didn't know what that had to do with not drinking, and I just went right down the tubes with it, and I got here the greatest way known to man. I got here mindless. You know, I didn't question and I didn't analyze, not because that wasn't my nature, it's because I wasn't able to anymore. I just did it, you know, and there were magic words to me. The magic words, it was very, very simple for me, and it stayed very simple for me, and they told me to keep it very simple, and there was a marvelous Irishman, and he knew just how to handle me, and whatever he wanted me to do, he would just say, "Oh, you'll get drunk." And I did it, you know, I just did it. I mean, and I didn't understand what it had to do with staying sober, and I didn't care what it had to do with staying sober. I didn't know there's a chance in hell I could stay sober. And, I mean, I knew somehow, some way, the tidal wave was going to come in and sweep me out drunk again. And I've been sober, God, 20 years and 2 months and 16 days, and the great thing that's happened for me is that I am as aware of being sober today, and I am as aware of the miracle of that today as I was when I was 2 weeks. I mean, I would walk around, I weighed 145 pounds, and I was insane. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous puts up with a lot of insanity, you know. And I was one of those, you know, I was one of those who just walked in here mad. Just mad. And I was going to get in here, I was going to stay sober, and I was going to have everything to do, and I was just at every meeting in town, and I was like, what do you want me to do, you know? And and I was terrified of everybody. I was terrified of everybody, I was terrified of the noise, terrified of the laughter. I knew you all, I had someone to go home with. I knew I was less than absolutely everybody here, which is also a great way to get here. I didn't come in here having to tear down all that structure of being better than. I've had to build a structure here of being as good as. I've had to build a structure for me where I may not even be as good as, but I'm as good as I am today. And that's what I have, and that's what I'm stuck with. And I've grown and grown and grown and grown and grown and grown. And I don't stand here tonight with 20 years of sobriety for you to think that I have it all together and that I have all the answers, because what it has done for me is I don't have to have the answers. And I don't have to have it all together all the time. And I don't have to know everything. I just have to be sober and have become what I have become and be comfortable with it. And I'm comfortable with me today. And I was never comfortable before I got here. It didn't make any difference how much I had gotten. And I had no idea why I drank. And it didn't make any difference. I had never been guilty of introspection before I got here. I had just gone out to get what I wanted when I wanted and get it, and that's all I cared about, and that's all I thought of, and I never even thought of how well I felt or what it made me feel like or who I was. I never thought about it. I just thought about getting what I wanted. I never even looked at what I wanted or whether it was valid for me, or I just ricocheted off a lot of walls getting it, and I got a lot. I didn't get here poor. I got here too frightened to ask my own lawyer for money, and they were shutting down my whole life and selling everything off, and I had no idea what was happening. I vanished. I was evicted from a psychiatric sanitarium. I where I had been 23 times. I had gotten well 23 times. I mean, when you don't know you're sick, there's no way that you can get well. And what I had classified as getting well was getting sober, and I got sober with absolutely no tools, and I went back every single time. The first time I was in there was 3 days, 3 years before I got here. And I stayed 2 days, and they couldn't hold me. I mean, I'd gotten it together. They'd gotten me sober. I didn't know what I was doing there. And I went back out into that world, the same raving maniac I had always been, and put that flag up that pole one more time. And I think I stayed sober maybe 85 days or something. And something terrible happened, like the wrong thing came in the mail. I hadn't drunk out of a glass for maybe 5 years before I got here. I hadn't lost the obsession to drink for maybe 3 years before I got here. I mean, that's all my mind could finally focus on. That's all my mind wanted. That's all my mind did. And I'd never even lost the craving. Being in that sanitarium, and they'd sober me up, the craving never left. I mean, I was already drunk. It wasn't just as good as drunk. I mean, I was already drunk. The craving to drink physically never left me. I mean, I'd sit in a psychiatrist's office when I was finally an outpatient, in between times in. And I'd sit in this, and all I could think of for 45 minutes was, I have 15 minutes before the car picks me up. Where's the liquor store? What am I wearing? How big is the bottle? How can I get it? Where can I carry it? How do I get it in? Where do I stash it? My life was absolutely, totally concerned with how to get drunk, how to stay drunk, and how not to get sober. I never looked at that. It was who I was. I mean, how can you tell a psychiatrist when he's sitting across the table from you that you have to have a drink? That it has nothing to do with your parents. It has nothing to do with anything he wants to discuss. Where I was at finally was I had to have a drink. And you can talk about all that other stuff as much as you want. I had to have a drink. And I just sat there, and I fortunately had enough money to pay for all of that. And it didn't make any difference. And it was my final rationalization, the psychiatrist thing. And I think psychiatry a lot today is a lot of rationalization for bad behavior. Let's sit down and discuss my doing this. What I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous, in order to change here, it's exactly as being sober has worked for me. I couldn't get into why I drank first and then get sober. I would have been dead by now. I would have been dead years ago. I had to get sober first. And then being sober faced the world one thing at a time to understand who I was with it, what my reactions were with it, and what the big book meant in that direction. I had never been a student, fortunately, so I never treated the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous intellectually. I didn't learn it. I cannot recite it. I do not know which page anything is on. I have consistently finally gone to a big book study every Sunday night with a speaker on a step for the last 7 years after all the other ones I went to. Because I know when all the rest of it gets thrown out the window and everybody else fails you and there's nobody left here, that what is going to keep me sober? The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's that simple. And I didn't understand the steps. God, were there meetings? They would read them. They'd read the 12 steps. And it was like, oh my God. I couldn't handle that all at once. I couldn't handle anything all at once. Which is why they tell us one day at a time. I wasn't able to handle one day at a time around here. 24 hours a day was for the adults. I had to learn how to keep my mind focused on what I was doing right now. If I was brushing my teeth, I had to be brushing my teeth, telling my head that what it was doing was brushing its teeth. Because my head always got away from the teeth. My head got from the teeth into the shave, into the shower, into the making the bed, and into the clothes, and into making the coffee, and the cigarette, and out the door, and I went insane. And the teeth never got brushed. It was the greatest thing in the world. I mean, I had to practice this program. I had nothing else going for me. except what I heard in meetings. What saved my life were the people who had the courage to stand up at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous day after day after day after day and give me the hope that I could stay sober. I never had the hope that I could be what I felt them to be and have become what I felt they had become. I had the hope I could stay sober, and I would take home a little piece of something every single meeting. They talk about spiritual awakenings. They talk about spiritual experience. Let me tell you, every single meeting was a spiritual experience for me. And I don't mean just that it stopped the craziness. I don't mean just that it took the top off it. It was every single time I would be at a meeting, somebody who talked would turn the key for me in something that I didn't even know was a problem. If somebody talked simple enough, if someone kept it graphically small enough for me to be able to absorb and put in my pocket and take with me, I got it. I never got all the grandiose, egocentric, mad, psychological, let me tell you who I am stuff. I never got it. I never understood it. I got the little things. I got when someone translated the Serenity Prayer, which I knew was a Serenity Prayer. All right, Serenity Prayer. And everybody was always saying the Serenity Prayer all the time. And it was translated for me as an alcoholic. And as an alcoholic, my problem, it may be hard for you to believe, that my problem is other people. And how a Serenity Prayer translates is the only thing I can change is me and my reaction to them. That I cannot change anybody else. I never knew. I nearly fell off my chair that night. I never knew that all my life I've been out there trying to change everybody else and change everybody else's reaction to me and change what everybody else thought about me, what everybody else did for me, and when they did it and how they did it. I never even knew that till that night. And that wasn't my job. My job was me. My job in order to get along with everybody in this room is just to let you be. To let you be. You're not my problem. Thank God you're not my problem. What I have survived sober is me. I have survived me 7,366 days. With the enemy attached to my shoulders. You know, not even riding on my back anymore. I had some mad idea that when you come through a nightmare like I had come through, I mean, when it was all gone and all over and I ended up here mindless and I wasn't able to write and I wasn't able to read. I didn't even know I wasn't able to read. And I could not hold two sentences together. I could not remember anything. As a consequence, I did not talk. I just listened, and I had pat things I said in answer because I did not know what I was going to answer. I did not know what to say, and I could not remember anything. And I taught myself to read in my third year of sobriety. I got this program by listening. I got this program by hearing what other people's experience was sober. And God bless everybody who ever shared anything. There was a lady one night sitting across a room, and you know how you pick up on it, especially if it's weird. And I was sitting there, and I heard this rather insane voice, and she's got a year more sobriety than me. And I heard this voice say, "My job is to push back the needle." And I thought, oh, well, now. And then she explained what she was talking about. And I got it. I got it because it was simple and it was graphic and it was the truth. That, you know, that what my life is a tapestry. That I don't know what it's supposed to be and I don't know what the design is and I don't know what the colors are and I don't know how long it's supposed to be put together. Because I'm on the wrong side of the tapestry, you know, all that stuff and the knots and the yarns and the pieces of the yarns. And I have always God knows what it looked like before I got here. I was always pushing back a needle, getting what I wanted in the right color. And my job sober has been always sitting in the wrong place waiting for the needle to come out with the wrong color. And when it comes out, and you're sitting there waiting for a black piece of yarn in the left-hand corner, and you're waiting to pick it out, and it comes out in the right-hand corner with a yellow piece of yarn. And what my job is in my life is not to question it, but to go over and push back the needle. Because what I would like my life to be sober is what it's supposed to be, not what I make of it. What I am here is willing. What I have always been here is willing. I mean, I learned to say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have taken that yes out there into the world. My natural mindset is to say no. No, I have nothing to do, but I can't be there. I'm sorry. I have learned to say yes, and they said it to me, and I didn't understand what they were saying. I just did it. They said, "What have you got to lose?" And I think they got to be kidding. What do you mean you got to lose? They said, "The only mistake you can make is taking the first drink." They're crazy people. And that has been the truth. That has been the truth. Well, I have probably the only mistake I haven't made sober is I have not taken the first drink. So I have been able to survive my own mistakes, and I have always been given the hope of tomorrow. And all that happened because I got here a helpless, hopeless, dying drunk. I didn't even know how hopeless I was. I didn't even know how helpless I was until I stayed sober and until they cut off all the avenues of my hiding. I had no place left to hide. The house was gone, the servants were gone, the business was gone, and everything else started to disappear. I had to walk away from the psychiatrist because he was conflicting with Alcoholics Anonymous. What he was doing without knowing it was he was conflicting with my sanity. He was telling me, as I was sitting across the desk from him in a way he had never known me, I was sober. And he was saying, "The name of the game for you has to be total exposure." And what I was being told here was that wasn't important. That what I had to do, reading magazines wasn't important. Doing anything else wasn't important. That the most important thing of my life was staying sober. The most important thing in my life was staying in the now. The most important thing in my life was going to one meeting after another. And what, of course, that took was trust. I had no life left going for me when I got here. And this didn't turn into some mad, marvelous miracle. I didn't get struck well. I didn't get struck wonderful. I didn't get struck good-looking. I didn't get struck healthy. A career did not happen for me right away. I did not know where to go or what to do or how to do it. I got here and got sober and did what I was asked to do. And I found prayer here fast. And I'm one of the ones that got here not even knowing the words of a Lord's Prayer. And I became very aware that I didn't know the words of a Lord's Prayer. You know, it became probably the single most important thing in a meeting to me. And that's why I always hate those meetings where they say to a brand newcomer, "Now, Susie will do the prayer of her choice." You know. And I sit there terrified that Susie's not going to do the Lord's Prayer. And Susie usually doesn't. And I feel like I've missed something. Because what has worked for me to keep me sober, and I was aware of that at the beginning, I didn't know. I mean, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and the mental obsession was gone and the craving was gone. And what worked for me, I mean, I was 2 weeks sober. The winners around here, the winners weren't people with 20 years. I mean, they were fantasy. I mean, they were beyond my ken totally. The people who had it were people who had 30 days sobriety here. The people who were the winners then became people with 90 days. Then they became the people with 1 year. And I always watched them. I watched and listened to them. Where they were at, what they did, what was going on with them. And I do the same thing today. It's why today I love meetings with a lot of sobriety in them. Because I sit there and just watch the people with 27 years. And I would not judging, but watching. I'm so glad to see them. And I love them looking healthy, and I love them looking well. You know, and I love the success. I love success stories. And that's what you have in Alcoholics Anonymous. You live in the middle of a million miracles. And you don't see someone for 3 years, and you walk right by them. Because you don't recognize them anymore. You certainly don't recognize the smile. And that's what happens, yes, that's what happens to people. Smiling in here. It's laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand the laughter when I got here. How can you come through the nightmare I come through, crawling through a house dead drunk, in desperate search of something to drink so you wouldn't convulse one more time. Crawling in a back closet in a third story of your own house, and then somehow they found you to get you back to the nut house one more time and sober you up before you die. I mean, that's how I lived before I got here. And they'd shake me up and give me a pack of sleeping pills, and I'd be off to Europe on an assignment. I'm terrified I might drink, because I never knew where a drink was going to take me, which is why I never wanted to be far from home base, because I had turned into a horizontal drinker, you know. I love those stories about cocktail parties in here and people who are at bars and living it up, you know. And I was drinking behind locked doors, you know, barricaded in my bed with bottles under the mattress. Very elegant life. I'd worked a lot of years to have that life. A lot of years to have those servants walking in the hallway, and I had to wait till they went to bed to have something to eat because I was terrified of them. I used to go down and forage for food in my own kitchen. And I'd pass out, and I'd never even know how long later it was that I woke up. And one day I almost sliced my finger off in the dark trying to get something to eat in the kitchen. And I woke up with this voice, or the housekeeper, leaning over me in bed saying, "Why don't you paint the bathroom red?" I think I gave her a raise. It was very important to keep her around. Somebody had to answer the door. I mean, you can't crawl to the door and open it. It's just... I was writing a newspaper column at the end of it all. I mean, it was all insanity. Desperate, insane, holding on to everything, insanity, and I couldn't stop drinking. And I'd started this newspaper column 3 years before I got sober, and it had started off, it was the top news syndicate out of New York, and I went out with something called Women's News Service into 65 dailies, and then I ended up, when I got sober, it was getting 270 papers. And we were starting to run it as a feature spread instead of just a newspaper column. And I would write it mostly in the nut house. I mean, I never was sane enough. I was absolutely never sane enough. I was just like... And then I had stopped. I used to have to write it all on Saturday morning before I got drunk by noon. And then that was out of the question because I had already, even Saturdays I was drunk by 8. I was just drunk. So the only time I was ever sober was in the nut house. They'd get me in there and they'd pull me together and shake me up and I'd call the office and they'd send in the typewriter and they'd send in my briefcase and where all the interviews were. It was a celebrity newspaper column. It was called A Talent for Living. Oh, God. I did. The lawyer canceled out that newspaper column like he canceled. They canceled out my whole life. By the grace of God, they canceled out my whole life. And they started to sell me out and sell me off. And it wasn't just that I couldn't think well enough to write a newspaper column. I wasn't able to use my hands well enough to type. That's how I got here. And that's how my life was able to change. It wasn't that I got here wonderful saying, "Okay, God, take me and do with me what you will." It was, that's what it had to be. Because I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know where to go, and I didn't know how to make money again. And I started to try, in the only tunnel vision direction I knew, to try to get it started again, and it all flaked, and nothing happened, and I was broke 3 years sober. I finally hit the financial bottom 3 years sober. And I started all over again, and I started all over again. I had always stood on the outside of the world, and I didn't know that. I had always been the critic. I had always been the judge. I mean, my idea of me was I was so wonderful and altruistic, and I'd helped all these people. And the truth of it was I had never helped anybody unless there was something in me for it. Nobody had ever done anything to me. I allowed them to do it so I could get something I wanted. And I found that out sober, too. You find out all these wonderful things after you stay sober a while. And it was like that one of those promises that I read when I was 18 months sober. I didn't know there were 12 promises here. The people I got sober with didn't tell you there were 12 promises. They weren't holding out any carrots. They said the miracle here is the plug in the jug, and you never have to drink again if you work your ass off here. And that was the miracle to me. That was the greatest words I'd ever heard in my life. You never have to drink again. And there's that one where you never regret the past and I wish to shut the door on it. And I read that when I was 18 months sober, and I thought it could never be. It could never be. You could never come through the hole I come through and the destruction I had come through, that I was starting to realize that I had just destroyed everything. I mean, I had not done it on purpose. I had just trampled through everyone's life just getting what I wanted, you know. And when I was through getting what I wanted, I just trampled off into somebody else's life. I mean, I used people. I was a user, and I didn't know that. I didn't even know I had used alcohol. I had no touch with me. I had no touch with my own reality when I got here. I just came in here, and this was the last stop in town. And I worked at it, and I worked for it. You know, when they say there are no dues or fees here, they mean the basket being packed. There are a lot of dues and a lot of fees to pay in Alcoholics Anonymous if you want to stay sober. If you're desperate enough, and by the grace of God, you've been beaten enough and you're desperate enough to do whatever it takes to stay sober, because this is something that doesn't rub off on you. And that's why they used to put us in the front row. Mark Kennedy used to say, "If you're sitting in the back, you'll go out the back." I suggest you sit in front. No, but sit in front. I was in front. So you had to go out the back. You know, I was too frightened of people. I couldn't ask a secretary to help at a meeting. I would just get there and set the chairs up. Hour before a secretary got there. And I never tell her who set them up, because maybe they weren't set up right. I just did it. I just did it, and all the cripples came to me. Of course all the cripples came to me. I didn't realize that. I thought I was wonderful. It's because I was a cripple. Cripples go to cripples, right? So I always had a station wagon full of cripples. I mean, we played Last One to the, you know, we'd get to a meeting and the last one to the seat, the rotten egg, and we just go running in the room, you know. See, the program of alcohol, this is a very sacred place, is these meetings to me. I suppose it's why people like, when you get some sobriety and this thing has worked and continues to work and you continue to change, and you start to become all those things you heard those people be that you thought you could never be. Alcoholics Anonymous becomes more and more of a sacred place. And as a consequence, you get a little bit adamant about how it's being handled and the program. It's wonderful that all those other programs are out there for all those other people. It's the greatest thing that ever happened on the face of the earth. All the other psychotics have someplace to go. You know, that's fabulous. But this is Alcoholics Anonymous that works for the drunk. This is the place where we become our own miracles. And no one knows where somebody else is coming from. No one knows my miracle. No one knows the quietness and softness of how I feel today compared to the insanity of what I used to be like and what my head used to do with me until I'd been given the tools to do it, to let go. To let go and let life happen to me and be willing to do whatever it is that's put in front of me to the best of my ability. I stood on the outside judging everybody. Everything I ever did all my life was on architecture and decoration. I worked for all those magazines. I worked for all those advertising agencies. And I turned out all those, you know, 14 or 15 creative campaigns every single day. And I did all that writing and I did all that drawing and I did all that drafting. And I never had the courage to stand out in front of the designer. And I got sober, and I suddenly had to become a creator instead of a criticizer. And nothing would work for me. Nothing would work for me. And I was just open to what was happening. You get open to what's happening. You get open to prayer because you have no alternatives here. You don't get good enough and bright enough to do it. You do it because, God damn it, there's nothing else to do, and you're going insane. And you're going broke. I was nearly 3 years sober. I went to my sponsor's wife and I said, it was so hard for me to
to honestly say what was going on with me, because I knew you were going to throw me away. And Joanne said, how are you tonight? And I thought, my head said, tonight's the night. We'll tell her. And I looked at her and I said, I'm going broke. I said, as a matter of fact, I'm practically there. And she said, you are? She said, how does that feel? I never had any money. you know, it's called God comes in shoe leather, you know? And that's exactly what it is. God does come in shoe leather. I had a little friend who had been a nun who hated everybody, and everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous especially. And we were great friends, and we were together all the time. She was as crazy as I was and as frightened as I was. And the only way we stayed in the supermarkets, we used to play tag with the carts. One day I was coming around with how I was given a new career. I came around the end of a gondola, and I knocked an old lady down. I was chasing the nun around the end of the gondola. And my cart hit this old lady, and she looked up off the floor and said, my God, it's Donald Madden, where have you been? And she took me under her wing. The old lady, she was very important in this town, and had known me before I got sober. She introduced me at a huge lunch one day, which was full of every magazine editor in the world, but I never wanted to see again. An editor came over and said, where have you been? And I said, I've been away. She said, what are you doing? And I said, nothing. I said, I'm just remodeling a house for myself. She said, oh, you are? She said, I'm on deadline, and I can't find anything, and I have 2 pages to fill, and I got to shoot by next Wednesday. Can I come look this afternoon? I said, sure. And she came, and she looked at it, and she said, it's great. Finish it. I'm shooting next Wednesday. And it was my first color layout as an interior designer. Now, they didn't know what to do with me. The headline read, writer, designer. They didn't know how to place me, even. I mean, they were aware of how confused I was. I was, you know. And I got a small job from that. I still was looking to get something else going. I came in here wrapped like I was, with the same tunnel vision in place. I didn't know any different. I didn't know any different about living, about doing, about reacting. It was the beginning for me. I had, 6 houses published in the Home magazine, everything I did, they kept shooting, it's been a long go for me. You come in the back door like that when you've been Mr., you know, and suddenly there you are just doing it. And there you are with no money to back you up. And there you are having to learn how to get along with clients. And there you are having to learn how to ask for money. I had more clients take me to the cleaners. I had a lawyer who said, you've been taking the cleaners so many times, why don't you just open up a cleaning shop? You know, I didn't know how to operate emotionally, I had no idea how to operate. I did it. I did it because I had to. I did everything because I had to do it. And I didn't want to run anymore, and I didn't want to hide anymore. And I got up in the morning, and I never pulled the draperies. And when I was up, I was up. I made the bed behind me so I couldn't get in it. And I just kept going, as terrified as I was. I was always shaved, I was always clean, I was always dressed, I was always going. I just stayed up, I just did it, I just went to meetings. And if I only had a buck finally for gas or food, it had to go for gas because I was always picking up new people on this program. Then you got to go through the fear of driving into a gas station asking for $1 worth of gas. Oh, Christ, you know it. I've been at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous since I was about 2 years sober. I mean, they love insanity here, you know. I remember I didn't have any money for new tires, and every gas station I drove in, they would say, don't drive more than 20 miles an hour on these tires. And I'd have to go speak down in Christ, like La Cañada, or way down a freeway in some godforsaken place, you know. I always drove at 65 miles an hour on the freeway getting there because I knew God would take me there to carry the message. After the meeting, I always drove home on surface streets at 20 miles an hour. Because I knew. I mean, that's how my head was. You know. I knew that God would take me there for the message, and after I was through with the message, fuck him. if you hear I died on the freeway tonight on the way home, you'll know. I sometimes today, you know, it's all still so, I don't know why, it's so hard to say to you, it's 20 years, and yet it's all still so new to me. Who I am, and how I live is so, I'm so aware of, and it's still so new to me. I don't practice these steps. They have become who I am. I keep it very simple for me. I just say to God every morning, and sometimes all day long, you still have a child on your hands, and I don't know what to do, when to do it, why to do it, where to do it, or how to do it. So just give me the knowledge of your will for me, and I get out there and I do a day. And everybody said, how do you know the difference between God's will and your will? Is God's will is what happens to you, good or bad, and your will is what doesn't. Period. Period. I mean, it's all like you turn it over to God and you expect the whole world to be marvelous. I didn't understand. I was always in the wrong direction. Of course I got a million things where I hit a brick wall and it didn't happen for me. And I got put on my hands and knees one more time. How am I supposed to recognize what a wrong direction is? The little sign on the brick wall said, turn left. But I've had the willingness to turn left. I used to just dynamite the wall down. I've always had the willingness here. You know, I've always had the willingness. And it hasn't been easy for me growing up. It hasn't been easy for me to come through all that psychotic madness of who I was. And a child that had never grown up and never known how to live and never known how to love and never known how to have friends and never known how to really get along with anyone on any other kind of basis in the world. I had never known it. I have clients today, and I have just had to start recognizing, I have clients today who love me. I mean, they really love me. And I don't just mean as a designer. I've written a newspaper column against soap. I said I would never write again as long as I lived. And you know, whenever you say the word never, it goes through the magic box, you know. And they say, well, he said it, you know. We love him, but he said it, you know, God. And it was a great thing. And I was given, it was a new syndicated Sunday supplement, tabloid size. And they gave me two columns every Sunday, and I ended up with a full page every Sunday. And it was written in total who I am today, in total just train of consciousness. It was absolutely marvelous, and it wasn't predicated on what you thought of me or what they thought of me. It was predicated on everything I had ever thought or ever learned and every experience I had ever had. It happened one night when I was going out, I was 5 years sober, and I was on my way out to do a question and answer meeting. And this woman called and said, they're putting this thing together, or will you write a newspaper column again? And I said, I learned to say yes here. I said, yes. And she said, what kind will you do? And I said, I don't know. I'll call you when I get back. And I came back, I did a question and answer thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called on the phone, I said, I'll do a question and answer newspaper column. And it ran for 4 years. And it finally ran in full pages. And it was marvelous. It was marvelous because it was just me. It should have been called Middle Finger Exercise. Is what. I mean, I got back at everything I'd ever wanted to get back to, including cottage cheese ceilings right down the line, you know. I just said it, and I had the marvelous thing happen, too. I mean, for a total, you know, paranoid schizophrenic, to write a question and answer a newspaper column, because I had to do a lot of the questions myself. And I would do a question, and then I would write the answer in the middle of it. I'd put in, whoever wrote this question lost their mind. Or I'd write the answer first and then phrase a question for it, you know. And it was crazy and it was mad and they loved it. You know, they loved it. But they loved it because it was real. They loved it because it was truth. They loved it because it was honest. They loved it because it wasn't pompous and someone doing it who thought they could tell the whole world what to do. I'm not that anymore in my life. I don't want to be that. I don't want to be saddled with that. I'm not saddled anymore with who I was. I don't have to do a big thing with anybody anymore. I just am who I am. and it's good enough for me. Because that's all I've got. I'm not less than anybody, and I'm not better than anybody else. I'm just me. And my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Jesus, God, help me with some of them. And but I want to tell you, if I can go through all the insanity, you know, you look back and it has a lot of laughter, but when you're going through it, it ain't funny. It's just straight panic right down the line, you know, including planting a lawn. Oh, my God. It's going to come up red. You know, it's like, it does. It looks funny when you get 10 years away from it, but when you're doing it, it's insane. And what I did was I just did it. And I stayed sober and I kept moving and I've stayed here and kept helping. And as a consequence, I've been given it all. Thank you.